Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. Expresspros.com.
6:15 on this Tuesday morning. Man, it was hot yesterday when I did get a chance to leave the hospital for a little bit and walk around. It was miserably warm. Highs of 87 today, 86 tomorrow, 86 Thursday for the first day of the second weekend of Jazz Fest. 50% chance for showers on Friday. Highs of 84, 60% on Saturday. Highs of 81. And then 80 for a high on Sunday. We'll be into May by that point, and highs of 80, but dry. So maybe a little bit wet for a couple of days of Jazz Fest, but we'll get through it, right? And thankfully, no golf tournament today. This weekend, rather. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University, to talk about the first 100 days of President Trump's second term. How you doing, David?
I am doing well, and I hope you're well, too.
I am. I think that some people are going to see these poll numbers and either discount them because they think that the president's doing a great job and that they're happy, and that's fine. That's great. But tell me what these poll numbers show.
Well, we have multiple polls, so it's not just one source, and they're all indicating the same trend, that when Trump took office, he was doing fairly well in the polls. They would call it he was above water. That means he had an overall net positive rating. But what's happened now over the last 100 days is that consistently across all the polls, he's now, again, underwater, where more people disapprove of him than approve of him. Now, some polls might have slightly different numbers, but he's also suffered the most rapid decline in approval ratings of any president going back, as far as they've been doing polling. So the bottom line is, just in terms of supporting or liking his performance, the honeymoon's over. To use that phrase here, the honeymoon period where people say, new president, we like him, that or what, that's over. He's now down to about where he was when he was president, but not quite, like mid to low 40s. And if you look at his two signature issues, the economy and immigration, where for the longest period, that's where he had his biggest support, he's crashed there pretty significantly. So simple bottom line here is that his poll numbers are all significantly going in the wrong direction.
So how can that be? I guess is what I'm saying. If so many people were in favor of him when he got elected, what changed?
I think a couple of different things. One is that he was being evaluated in comparison to Joe Biden. I think I'm speculating on this, mm-hmm. And people did not like Biden's performance. And so they said, well, Trump looks pretty good. And maybe they look back at his first 4 years with the proverbial rose colored glasses and said that things looks not so bad. But also there's an indication that he's really he claimed he had a mandate, and he's overplaying it. And he's pushing on a lot of issues, such as tariffs, the economy, immigration, and poll numbers are suggesting that the American public doesn't like the idea that he's defying the courts. And so I would say, you know, he's overplaying the hand that he was dealt, and that's really leading to a lot of the problems in the polling numbers.
From a legal standpoint, because I know you you teach law as well, constitutional
right.
law, he's not seizing any power that has not been ceded to him, correct?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, I had somebody, one of my students asked me the other day and said, how has Trump amassed so much power? And I said, it's less that he's amassed so much power than Congress isn't doing its job. And I said, what's happening is that, you know, our framers had this concept called checks and balances, separation of powers. You know, I think we all learned that somewhere in, you know, grade school, high school or something like that. And Congress is supposed to be doing its job, and it's not. It's you know, it could come back at any time and pass a law that says, no tariffs. It could come back and say, we're going to redo the immigration policy. But what's really happened is they've basically given up their power. And because of that, that's why Trump is doing all these things, because Congress isn't doing its job.
So let's look at it historically. Presidential job approval at or near 100 days and compare it. I guess I'm looking at a poll here going all the way back to Truman and Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson. How do his numbers stack up? And even with Trump 1 as opposed to Trump 2.
Yeah, well, if we do that kind of comparison, that he's got lower polling numbers now than any of those predecessors going back to, again, probably Truman. I mean, Roosevelt becomes difficult because that puts us back into the 1930s mm-hmm. when polling was really, really not very good. But I could say that he's dropped more rapidly than any other president going back to Truman, and he's at lower number. His approval ratings now are lower now, even compared to his first term as Donald Trump as president of the United States.
I would think part of this is cause and effect, because he has, if you look at the executive orders that he's issued, again, he's not seizing any power that Congress has not ceded or given to him. Because of the amount of executive orders that he's issued, he's done far more than any of his predecessors, whether you like it or not, just in terms of activity, he's done far more than any of his predecessors have even come close to doing. Is that accurate?
In terms of executive orders, yes. Now, if we look, obviously, if we were to go back to somebody like Roosevelt, I mean, that's still the gold standard in terms of, you know, the 1933, you know, the Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, by the way, in his first 100 days, the amount of legislation that was adopted then far eclipses anything that any president has really ever done in American history. And remember, when he's taking over, it's the beginning of the Depression, you know, or not the beginning of the Depression, it's during the Depression. And so his is kind of an unusual benchmark here. But in terms of the number of executive orders that he's issued, by far exceeds. Now, if you're asking what has he accomplished with those executive orders, that becomes a different question, because issued a lot of executive orders, but also almost all of the executive orders are being challenged in the courts, and the vast majority of what he's executive ordering, is being hung up or stayed by courts. And this is a continuation of a pattern from his first 4 years. That, again, if we go back to Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and compare all the presidents in terms of their success rate in court, Trump's first term in office had the worst success rate in court of any president. What's that going back, like 7, 8, 9, whatever number of presidents that is at that point. And the same thing is happening again now. He's doing a lot of stuff, but it's the courts are just saying, you can't do that stuff. You're exceeding your constitutional authority.
So I guess that means if they hate Trump, they love the Democrats, right? Not so fast, my friend. We'll talk more when we come back. 6:22. Donald David Schultz, our guest, professor of political science at Hamline University. Democrats not doing so well either. Traffic now, WWL. It is 6:25 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about some poll numbers with President Trump. And people are texting in. Well, one person's texting in, apparently thinking that there's a conspiracy and that it's all negative and George Soros and blah, 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 blah. And people are entitled to believe what they want. However, it'd be interesting to see if these same people think that this poll is lying when they talk about the Democrats not being viewed much better than Trump, are they?
Oh, the best thing that Trump has going for him and the Republicans have going for him right now is that the Democrats poll even worse at this point. I mean, coming out of the election, you know, last November, you could say that the Democrats emerged as a third party. And what I mean by that, if you ask people when they exited the polls, do you consider yourself Democrat, Republican, or other? First it was Republican, then it was other, then it was Democrat. And it hasn't improved at this much at this point. So the Democrats are really, really in a bad position at this point because people just don't like the Democrats right now. And you look around and you try to find where the Democrats are in terms of taking on Trump or what they have to offer as an alternative. And I still think they're back to where they were last year, is to say, why should you vote for a Democrat? Because I'm not Trump. I'm not sure that gets you very far, and the poll numbers are reflecting that. So, yes, the same poll that is saying that Trump numbers have tanked, the exact same poll is saying that the same polls are saying that people don't like the Democrats,
so,
and they're doing worse.
So the only reason I mention that is, and for the two or three people, they constantly text in whenever they hear anything that is in any way slightly negative about Trump, presume that there's this massive conspiracy. I would just ask you then, does that same conspiracy apply to this poll, which shows that people like the Democrats even less than they do Trump? So it'd be kind of hard to say, you know, the whole thing's cooked except for this, that I want to believe in that. And it just kind of makes you look in the mirror and ask yourself about confirmation bias. With all of that being said, Trump's not up for re-election, I don't think. They talk about Trump 2028. Maybe it's a fundraising thing. Maybe it's a different Trump. I don't know. But the point is, it's all about his political popularity or the strength that he wields with the members of Congress at this point, right? Not necessarily the American people?
Absolutely correct at this point. And he still has a pretty powerful grip over the members of Congress's party. And that becomes the real interesting question now, because the members of Congress, you know, all the members of the House of Representatives, for example, are up for election next year. And this doesn't bode well for him, for these members of Congress. Now, granted, probably three quarters of them, maybe almost all of them, are safe. But there's about 35 congressional seats in the United States that are swing that'll determine the balance of power, whether the Democrats hold the House or Republicans. And those are the seats that Republicans need to be incredibly nervous about, because right now the odds are that the House will flip. Well, House will flip, and it always happens. The president's party generally loses the House of Representatives in the midterm elections. And so these are Republicans who have to think, well, if they keep towing the party line for Trump, they may be looking for a job come January 2027. Yeah.
And for those, again, that think, you know, there's some kind of propaganda, this, that, the other thing, it's got nothing to do with Trump. It's about correction and the way politics work in America with a presidential election and then the midterms, right? I mean, that's pretty much a historical fact.
It is a historical fact, compounded by the fact that now both parties overplay their and claim mandates. You know, for the most part, you win by a couple percentage points. You win by, you know, narrow margins, as Trump did, like by 1.5 points. You don't have a mandate, you know, and all the logic in the world should suggest that, guess what, it's that close. Hey, folks, how about compromising? But American politics now is winner take all, take no prisoners. And that just adds to the counter reactions in the next election.
Thank you, David. Appreciate your time and insight as always. David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. We'll take a break. We come back, we'll talk to Jan Moeller, executive director of Invest in Louisiana, about absenteeism in schools, and some lawmakers want to, I guess, take school funding away for students that are not in attendance. But having a teacher and a family, I know sometimes that's beyond the scope of what the school can do, and they fight with the parents to get the kids in school. So if you take funding away from the school, is that really fair? We'll find out when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7. Tommy Tucker, thanks for joining us on this warm, humid Tuesday morning. Jan Moeller joins us now, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana. How you doing, Jan?
I'm great, Tommy. Great to be with you.
I had a story that I was told people about earlier. A guy gets stranded on Mount Fuji, way, way up in the air, 10,000 feet above sea level. And then he had to go back. He forgot his phone and went back to get it and had to be rescued again. And I was asking people what the history was with cell phones. Somebody said, I've had 6 cell phones in 20 years. Yeah, I got my first one after Katrina. Still have all of them. Last phone I lost was a BlackBerry, so it's been a while. Somebody else said, never. Believe it or not, I have not lost a single phone ever, knock on wood, from somebody else. I lost mine in Walmart on Christmas Eve 2 years ago. And I got to tell you, Jan, if there is a time that you don't want to lose your cell phone, it's on Christmas Eve. And Walmart would not be the place. Have you lost cell phones ever or not?
I've left them places, but I've never actually lost one. I've forgotten them and had to go back, but never on Mount Fuji, Tommy.
No, and as crazy as it is, every time I go back to that Walmart, and it's been a year and a half, I still go check and see if anybody turned one in. Let's talk about this bill about absenteeism, because, you know, they got some commercials that we run about absenteeism, what a problem it is. They have a TV commercial that they're running, which is very good because it's this long scroll of names of kids that are absent from school, and it's a big problem, and we can talk about that, and then we'll talk about what this Louisiana lawmaker wants to do, which I think might be just a terrible idea. But let's talk about absenteeism in general. How big of a problem is that?
Well, it's an enormous problem, Tommy, and it's one that's actually getting worse. I live in East Baton Rouge Parish, and there was a report recently that 1 in 3 kids in public schools is chronically absent. That's more than 10 absences per year. And obviously, if kids aren't in school, they can't learn. And so this is absolutely a major problem.
Nearly 1 in 4 chronically absent last year, according to student data. I have a teacher in the family, and I know the challenges that the teachers face with, you know, is a kid coming to school? Where are they? What's going on? Haven't been here in a while. So it is the parents' responsibility to get the kid to school. This House Bill 185 by Barbara Freeburg in Baton Rouge would give schools money based on attendance data. But that, to me, it seems ridiculous because you're punishing the school for something over which they have no control, and you're punishing the students that do go to school by taking funding away for the ones that don't go. Is this all as bass-ackwards to you as it seems to me?
Well, Tommy, I think you hit on it. And so let me start by saying I feel almost guilty criticizing Representative Barbara Freiberg. She's a local state rep here in Baton Rouge, and she's somebody who's been working on education issues for a long, long time. She was a classroom teacher. She was on the school board here in Baton Rouge for years. She was on the Metro Council, and since she joined the legislature, she has worked really hard on education issues, particularly early childhood education. So she's somebody who has a long record of really putting kids first. But I think the problem with this bill is exactly what you describe. We know that absenteeism is a problem across the board, but it's an especially big problem in schools that serve a lot of low-income kids. It's poor kids who may have a lot of family issues and family dynamics that make it harder for them to get to school. Maybe parents lack reliable transportation. Maybe there's chaos in the home. There's all kinds of things that the school has nothing to do about. And you're right, Tommy. I mean, my wife is a third-grade teacher, so in a low-income school here in Baton Rouge, so I hear about this every single day.
Same story, Jan. Third grade, same thing. And you hear the stories as well. The kids can't read, and they get the kids in third grade that can't read, and they expect the teachers to teach them other things, which is hard when you can't read when you're in third grade. And I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm just giving you the audience a snapshot of what it is. And then you can't get the parents to take them to school. So what exactly is the teacher or the school supposed to do?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, my wife literally just left for school, and there's really nothing that she can do. She teaches the kids who show up. And right now, the way the per pupil funding formula works is they take enrollment twice a year on October 1st and February 1st. Whatever the enrollment is in that school, you multiply that times the per student amount, and that's what the school gets. Now, maybe you have a class of 20 kids, but let's say only 15 of them show up on a particular day, or 12 because the weather is bad that day. It still takes the same teacher to teach that class. The costs of running that school don't go down. So I think the concern is if you start punishing schools that have higher rates of absenteeism, you know, I understand that the goal is to try to give schools an incentive to do something about this. But I think really the problem, as you said, is really more societal, and it has to do with factors that the school really can't control. So the concern is you would actually reduce money going to the places where those resources are needed the most.
Yeah, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. And the question is, what can the schools do? And I would ask the audience, if you got any questions or suggestions here, Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Text, data, and message rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. You got to understand also what happens here is the kid misses 3 days, 4 days, 5 days a week of school. They can barely read. They come in and they're behind. So what do you want the teacher to do? Do you want the teacher to stop everything and go back and hold the entire class back so you can catch up the two or three students that didn't come to school? Or do you just want to skip them and just keep teaching the rest of the class? But guess what? The LEAP test is coming up, or just happened, actually, and you're going to be judged by that as well. And the scores for those that don't show up, I think, are a zero. Is that right, Jan?
I think so.
Yeah. So that's what you're judged on. So y'all that think there's an easy solution to solving the education problems in this state, you need to talk to a couple of third grade teachers to find out what the hell's going on. I really mean that. And Jan just told you from his wife, and I can tell you from my family member. 651 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 656, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana, about the problem of absenteeism in schools. And it is a big problem that holds everybody back in a way, I guess. Jan, and this bill by the representative from Baton Rouge is misguided. And the only thing, and I don't mean to call her out or throw her under the bus for this, but Barbara Freiberg from Baton Rouge, she was a teacher. She's got to know. And what I'm getting at here, Jan, in my own way, is that there are things that will really help. There are things that will not help. She's got to know this is not going to do anything for absenteeism.
Well, again, I think I don't
mean to put you in an awkward spot, but
I think she's coming at this from a good place. But I think, and she said, I've heard her say she really just wants to spark a conversation about mm-hmm. how you do this. But the question is, what resources do schools need in order to try to reduce absenteeism, which I think everybody agrees is a problem, and taking away resources from the schools where absenteeism is the biggest problem doesn't seem like the right answer. Now, in California, they have a formula. You know, this all happens through a funding formula for education that mm-hmm. the state that BSEE, the Education Board, passes every year, and the legislature is supposed to approve it, though they haven't done that most years. California has a similar formula that is based on actual attendance, not just enrollment. But what they do is also give extra dollars to the schools with the highest needs, with highest poverty, more English language learners, more students with disabilities. But again, it's a question of what do you want the schools to do? I know anytime my kids are absent, if they're just late by 30 minutes, I get a text message from that school. I get a voicemail from that school. So schools are already doing what they can, but again, they can't control. They can't force a mom to put their kids on the bus. Maybe mom had to go to work a little early because a lot of parents are working two or three jobs, and those kids, it's on them. Maybe everybody doesn't have a mom and a dad to put the kid, get the kid off to school every day. So there's a lot of things that go into absenteeism, and I'm not sure this bill is the answer.
So other things making its way through the legislature that has other bills maybe that have your attention that could improve schools?
Well, I think the big question for the legislature right now, and let's just back up and say the schools, reading scores in Louisiana have improved significantly in the last couple of years. Teachers in public schools throughout the state are doing a heroic job under very difficult circumstances. They're in danger of getting a pay cut right now in the current budget. So the best thing the legislature can do is make sure teachers don't get a pay cut, that they renew the stipends that are expiring. And then let's have a conversation about how we get resources in the right way to the schools where absenteeism is really such a chronic problem and is keeping kids from catching up. And in fact, kids are falling farther and farther behind just because they can't make it to school every day.
Thank you, Jan. Appreciate your time as always. As my daddy used to say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We'll talk to Mike Boeheim when we come back, Louisiana State Representative, about some bills that are making their way through the legislative session. And we'll talk to Keith Hinckley about the sediment diversion. 7:12 now on this Tuesday morning. It'll be a warm Tuesday, muggy. We're getting into May, so you know what that means. And then June 1st comes hurricane season, but we'll take it one step at a time. Mike Boeheim joins us now, Louisiana State Representative. Talk about some of the things he's got making their way through the legislature. How you doing, Representative?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about seafood first, because I know I got a copy of a letter here from Deborah Long, I think is her name, the head of the seafood something or the other. I'll get it out here. Give me a second. I'm reading through it. They just sent it to me. The Southern Shrimp Alliance. Tell me what you're doing with labeling seafood.
Well, we are asking FDA. It's actually testing. We want the FDA to up their testing on imported seafood in the United States. Other countries such as Japan, the European Union, and Canada are much more rigorous in their testing of seafood imports. And a lot that has to do with there are a lot of chemicals and antibiotics that are present in a lot of these farm-raised seafood products, pond-raised seafood products that come from predominantly Central America, South America, and Asia. And some of these chemicals they're finding in this imported seafood, the FDA bans domestic use. So while we can't use these chemicals here, which are considered hazardous, so it's good that we don't, but this is being used in other countries. And because we're not nearly as prolific and diligent in testing seafood imports, I think we're about 2% in the United States, thereabouts. These contaminated seafood products, predominantly shrimp, are getting into our food supply here through imports.
So this is separate and distinct from tariffs. This is about quality and safety, accurate?
Yes, this is testing. And while we appreciate the tariffs that have helped our commercial fishermen be a little bit more competitive with the imports, this is a safety issue. And not too long ago, the French Consul General's office in New Orleans hosted a symposium on tainted food. And one of the big areas that was discussed in their conference was seafood imports, particularly in the United States. So this is a big problem because of the way these operations overseas are managed, and they're not done to our standards here in the United States.
So you're a state representative. This would involve the USDA, which brings us to the delegation in Washington, and seemingly a lot of influence with the Speaker of the House and also the Majority Leader in the House. How does this interface with that?
Well, this is us sending a notice to our congressional delegation that we would like them to ramp up pressure on the FDA and the Trump administration regarding seafood testing. Now, I was told by Senator Kennedy in his office over the last few years that the Biden administration was not as they weren't as aggressive on this front, and I'm hoping that with the change in administration, there'll be a new posture when it comes to increased vigilance on FDA imported seafood testing.
Does DOGE have anything to do with this at all in funding?
Not directly. I know DOGE is looking at efficiencies in federal departments, but there may be an impact, but it would be an indirect. But this is something that's very important for our consumers.
It is, and I guess the reason what I'm asking, Mike, is how do you go from a resolution, which sounds great, to something actually being done? Because, again, the tariffs are one thing, but this is stuff that shouldn't be coming into the country that if we don't allow it, certainly people shouldn't be eating it, and there needs to be more due diligence when it comes to this. Accurate?
There does, and this is about raising awareness. This is about getting this inserted into the public conversation. And obviously, seafood imports are a sensitive issue for Louisiana, particularly because of our economy. In my case, I represent St. Bernard, which is a big commercial fishing industry that's taken a hit with the catastrophic drop in the price of seafood. Fresh Gulf-caught seafood that's healthy versus this stuff being, you know, sent in from overseas. But you know, with the Trump administration began, you know, in earnest, which is trying to get this on their radar and make some noise. And we are a state that is blessed with having people like Speaker Johnson and Majority Leader Scalise in positions of influence. But we just want to get people paying attention to this issue, because it's not just an economic issue. It is a safety issue for our people.
You think that, and again, I understand, am I getting the attention of the delegation in Washington, but do you think the consumer has any idea what they're eating when they get this stuff?
No, and this is also another good way of letting folks know that when you buy imported seafood, with this discussion, we're talking about all these antibiotics and all these chemicals that we cannot utilize in domestic seafood raising here. That you really, it's not, when you're paying that for that cheaper price for that imported seafood, you might be doing something that's not so good for your health. You may want to be mindful of that. So this is about raising the awareness of consumers about potential consequences of buying and consuming imported seafood.
And look, we're going to take a break. We'll pick up insurance and some other things on the other side of it, Mike. But for people that are just tuning in, we're talking about awareness and testing of foreign seafood. Tell me again to recap some of the things that are in foreign seafood that is not in domestic seafood.
Let's see, I've got the list right here. Let's see. Well, there's something called maleic green. There's oxytetracycline. There is fluorine quinolone. You have to forgive me. I'm not so good at pronouncing these. Nitrofurantoin. And these are all banned by the FDA.
So the FDA says you can't use it here. They use it there and then bring it into the country, and there's not enough testing to make sure that it's prevented from being brought into the country, right?
That's correct.
All right, let me pick it up. We come back. Mike Boeheim is our guest. He's a Louisiana State Representative. We'll talk about the rest of the session and some of the other things that are going through, particularly as it relates to insurance. 720 now, traffic, WWL. 7:24 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mike Boeheim, Louisiana State Representative. Mike, before we get to insurance, and this is not really about you as much as the situation, and that is, you talked about John Kennedy talking about Biden this and that, and I get so tired of hearing about Biden this and Biden that, and that's over with. He's gone. They lost, right? And the Republicans have the House. They have the Senate. I get emails every day with tons of executive orders that the president signed. And I don't mean to get you out of your wheelhouse or anything here. And if you don't feel comfortable talking about it, you don't have to. But it would seem like when it comes to this testing of seafood, the president could make this happen tomorrow with an executive order if he wanted to. Am I wrong?
To some degree, you're right. But just so that you know, this isn't just a partisan barb here. This wasn't something Senator Kennedy did, you know, with the election. St. Bernard Parish officials have been meeting with our commercial fishermen, with our members of Congress for years, and this has been a big issue. Well, the federal delegation has in Louisiana has leaned on the president at the time to try to step up the testing and the imports, and with tariffs on these seafood products coming in from overseas. And there just really was a reluctance there. That's not just a Democrat-Republican thing.
And I didn't mean to make it about partisanship, Mike. I guess what I'm saying is, just as a citizen, you know what? They, we, or you, however what pronoun you want to use, have the House, you have the Senate, you have the White House. Quit talking about what happened back then and do something now to fix it. And I don't seem to see a lot of that happening. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's why we're trying to start the conversation on FDA testing with this resolution. And Tom, if you don't mind, there is something I'd like to just point out.
Sure.
Unrelated. We passed it yesterday. This is a resolution I had memorializing Congress to delay the implementation of Real ID in Louisiana to next year. Most people don't realize this, but May 7th, mm-hmm. next week, Real ID takes effect. You are not going to be able to board a plane or go into a federal building unless your driver's license meets Real ID standard, or you will have to have your passport on you. This is a big issue because only 30% of Louisiana driver's licenses meet the Real ID requirement. So if you're going to be going out of town starting next week, please try to get your Real ID on your driver's license upgraded, or be prepared to bring a passport so you're not turned away at the airport.
So what would your bill do, Mike? How would that affect?
It's a resolution asking Congress to try, and there's been some discussion in Washington about pushing back the Real ID implementation deadline that's set for May 7th back further. And, of course, Louisiana, we have an even more unique situation because our OMV system was shut down mm-hmm. for weeks. So this is going to be something that affects a lot of your listeners going on their summer vacations, and we want them just to be aware when you go to the airport, if you do not have your Real ID, at least bring a passport with you, because you don't want to be turned away at the gate or lose your vacation or your cruise.
And again, not to belabor the point, but that could be done by executive order tomorrow as well, right?
I think that potentially, yeah, but it also may require some input from Congress. I know there has been some debate in Washington on this.
Let's talk about insurance what else is happening in the session, and are any real inroads being made to making insurance more affordable in Louisiana?
I would say so. We were there till after 8 o'clock last night, and we moved 16 insurance-related bills in the legislature yesterday. Yesterday was almost a 12-hour day at the state capitol. When you see them bringing the pizzas in, we know we're in for a long night. And since we saw that box of Papa John's walk in, we knew we were going to have a long one. But yes, we passed a lot of substantial bills yesterday, things that that enhance, well, that require a greater degree of disclosure and litigation, things that affect attorney's fees. We had a bill that repeals the Housley presumption, which was a major precedent by the state Supreme Court that puts the emphasis on the plaintiff when claiming that they had an injury, rather than the courts just assuming that person was fine at the beginning and all of the pain that they're enduring and suffering came from the incident. So we had a lot of activity on this because auto insurance is one of the big financial problems we face in Louisiana. We have the highest car insurance rate in America. 7% of our income goes towards auto insurance premiums. That's higher than any other state in America. And we tackled quite a number of bills. Like I said, 16 insurance bills were debated, they were voted on, and they were passed yesterday in the House, and they will be moving on to the Senate.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your time. As always, Mike Baham, Louisiana State Representative. We come back, we'll talk to Keith Hinckley, President of Plaquemines Parish, Gordon Dove, Chairman of the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, about a letter that the Corps sent that indicated some information was withheld. We'll get to the bottom of all of that when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. All right, 7:46, 14 till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Keith Hinckley, president of Plaquemines Parish, and maybe eventually by Gordon Dove, chairman of the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority. How you doing, Keith?
Morning, Tommy. It seems like you guys keep coming, going in and out on me here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Let me know if we got any other problems. I know we had a little bit of an issue with Gordon, and if we can get him, we'll put him on as well. First of all, kudos on the bridge tolls. We at least they're going into May now, right?
Yes. Yeah. I hear odds are on the 15th. Eh?
Yeah, I was getting around with Keith yesterday saying Boomtown put the line at 15, May 15th, and I'm betting the over on that, but we'll see. Let's talk about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, because I saw the letter from the Corps, and I was a little bit confused about what's going on here, and maybe we can take it back to the beginning. The state applied to the Corps for a permit, and the Corps didn't have everything they needed, but issued the permit anyway because they said the information didn't matter. But now they say the information matters. Why don't you tell me what's going on, Keith?
Well,
you're breaking.
Tommy, you broke off on me again. But you were talking about the information didn't matter.
I'm asking. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. The Corps said initially when they issued the permit that it didn't matter, but now they're saying it does matter, but that they didn't know what the information was. I'm confused as to how they would know it didn't matter.
Well, I don't see how anyone can say that the information didn't matter. It all matters because of the effects that it was going to have on the basin. We were able to stop this diversion at the point where, it all started with NFIP, with the flood and the base flood elevations. Mm-hmm. And, thank God we were able to grab it at that time because, we're at the office and we knew it was going to be a catastrophe for our parish. And that, they keep saying the science, but the science really tells us it's more detrimental to our parish and to our community than good.
So I'm reading from Joni Hess's story here from NOLA.com, and I'm just going to quote it. Corps officials stated in a previous letter to the state, obtained by the Times-Picayune, that it should have previously had information from a 2022 engineering report, but that the contents would have no effect on the permit. Corps officials now say that information and several other issues caused the Corps to reassess, and I guess that goes back to what I was saying earlier, where I don't know how this whole thing got to the point where it is, how the Corps could issue a permit on information they didn't have, saying the information was irrelevant.
You keep going in and out, but I'm just going to speak. I think I know what you're talking about. It's the fact that there was a whole litany of letters and requests studies that were supposed to be done, and why the Corps chose not to do them at that time, I don't know. Or was the state supposed to do?
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Can't get enough baseball? Start streaming MLB Network today. Get up to 15 out-of-market games a week live on any device, plus 24/7 access to MLB Network's award-winning shows, including live game look-ins and exclusive player interviews. And hear live radio play-by-play from all 30 clubs with MLB at Bat. Enjoy the home of baseball from virtually anywhere. Plans start as low as $5.99 per month. Sign up now at MLBNetwork.com/stream.
Available in the U.S. only. Blackout restriction applies. Visit MLB.com/subscribe for full terms and conditions.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today with
Sophie. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
I'd probably think that the state and CPRA at the time were supposed to do those studies, but they failed to do so. I don't know. And, you know, I have a hard time saying, you know, the previous administration, but, you know, they were really pushing hard prior to them getting out of office. And it seems like it's coming back to haunt them just a little bit here, quite a bit right now.
Speaking of haunting, we get haunted by some phone problems here occasionally. So we're going to perform an exorcism during the break. We'll try to get Gordon Dove on when we come back. We're talking with Keith Hinckley, president of Plaquemines Parish, about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. I was holding court with some people in the store formerly known as Balestra's on Sunday for about a half an hour about the whole thing, and really a lot of confusion. Nobody knows what's good, what's bad, what's the science, what's not the science. It's a big, giant step, I know that. So you would think, with all of this money involved, that you want to make damn sure you're doing the right thing. So we'll pick it up here. We come back, 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:53, 7 till 8, life is like a box of chocolates with the phone lines. Let's see if we got Gordon Dove in a little paper container there in our box of chocolates. You there, Gordon?
Yes, this is Gordon Dove, chairman of the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority for the state of Louisiana.
You're damn right it is. Keith Hinckley, president of Plaquemines Parish, with us as well. Gordon, tell me what's going on with this Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, because I was talking to Keith Hinckley before, and I don't know who withheld information from whom and what was in that information. Do you know?
Well, a little bit over a year ago, When I was appointed by the governor and ratified by the full Senate, we started looking into the diversion. The cost overruns are far above the monies that were allocated under the NIFWIF and NERDA funds of the BP fine settlement. So any monies above $2.88 billion comes out of the state of Louisiana, and the state would have to appropriate it. So right now, you're about $3.1 billion, and you haven't even gotten to a lot of issues that we found. What happened in 2023, there was a rush to get this thing started. It was only 90% engineering was done. Now, I don't know if you ever heard of engineering. Have you ever heard of anyone starting a project with 90% engineering? I haven't. Mm-hmm. I've been a state contractor in Louisiana. I've been building for it since 1977, and I never heard of starting a project with 90% engineering.
Well, you can start it, but you certainly can't give an estimate on how much it's going to cost unless it's been engineered all the way through, right?
It originally started at $750 million. It escalated to $1.5 billion, then $2.1 billion, then $2.8 billion. So it's about $3.1 billion and rising. The state of Louisiana doesn't. I mean, right now we have a lot of, you know, you've got 64 parishes in Louisiana. There's 20 coastal parishes. So the other 44 parishes have to give up a lot of money if you ever want to build this diversion. Mm-hmm. And then there's some other problems in it, Tommy. What happened when they rushed it to construction? Okay, in the Corps permit, and anyone listening can go look into the Corps of Engineers permit, it says you must have NFIP, National Flood Insurance Program, compliance of 8 parishes, Plaquemines being one of them, Jefferson, and also St. Charles, St. James, St. John, Terrebonne, Lafourche. Of course, you got to have Grand Isle and Lafitte, which is in Jefferson.
Wait, what does that mean, Gordon? What does NFIP compliance mean?
At the National Flood Insurance Program.
No, I know that, but what does compliance mean? Means that what, as it relates to the diversion?
The diversion is so large. Maximum output is 2 billion with a B gallons per hour, not mm-hmm. per day.
Right.
The minimum you can run it to be beneficial is 1.3 billion gallons an hour.
Okay.
So According to the EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, which was done by engineers, it will lift the basin 1'7" to 3 feet. Higher than that when you have a south wind pushing water in, and President Hinckley can explain to you all about south winds in that area.
So wait, now, when you say NFIP compliance, meaning it would change the whole equation when it comes to flood insurance, is that what you're saying?
Elevations are elevated.
Wait, say it again, Keith.
1.5 to 3 feet.
Say that again.
And remember, that was in a core permit. That should have been done prior to construction. But there was a rush to construction. You, August of 2023.
Wait, stop 1 second. Hang on. I think the light bulb just went off. So it's going to raise the base level, which means to be in compliance with the NFIP program, houses would have to be built higher. Is that what we're saying?
It could well be, yes.
Gotcha, okay.
They never did it, so I can't answer that question. But I would think, yes, if you're going to lift that basin, then you lifted sea level elevation, which your BFE, your base flood elevation on homes are based on. That should have been done prior to it. But the construction went out in 2023, and that was 2 months before the election in which Jeff Landry was elected governor, and he took office in January of 24. The models you're talking about, that there was some redaction done, was in 2022 when it was submitted to the Corps of Engineers. That is one of the main reasons that the Corps suspended the permit. Now, the Corps suspended the permit. What we did is suspend for 90 days with the contractor, the construction portion of it, because it was costing so much money with nothing going on. It was just good business sense to stop the bleeding. But getting back to the NFIP, all eight parishes have to, your NFIP is administered by the parishes, correct? The parishes administer their own NFIP program with FEMA. The state does not administer that program. So that had to be approved. That was not approved. 800 buyouts. Because you lifted this basin up to 3 feet, you got camps and there's a marina back there from Myrtle Grove to Happy Jack to the communities along there. You have to build bulkheads and lift up these bulkheads to these camps. So they have a voluntary buyout. Well, when you're going to push 2 billion gallons of the polluted Mississippi River that has arsenic, barium, cadmium, the fecal levels with E. coli, and you can't swim in it, and you're going to lift that basin that high, the Barataria Basin becomes the Mississippi River. Now, I don't know about you, but my kids, I would not let my grandchildren or my children swim in that.
All right, Gordon, let me interrupt for a second. Keith, we got like 12 seconds left. So now all full stop until what?
All things stop until they can obtain permits. And we really don't see that this moving forward in this design. I truly believe we're going to be starting over and we're going to be negotiating a different diversion of sorts.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your time. We'll take a break. Come back on WWL. It is 8:14 now on this humid Tuesday morning. It'll be a hot and humid week, but it's getting ready to be May, so get used to it. What's going on with Hollywood South? Let's find out. Jason Wagasback joins us now, president of Film Louisiana. Is it drying up or not? How you doing, Jason?
Hey, Tommy. Thanks for having me again today.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me, what is the situation with Hollywood South and maybe some context where it was and where it is now?
Sure. Well, I mean, we hit a nice peak down in 2001, 2002, and then I think we discussed last time I was on the bumpy roads of union strikes and trying to understand what our business looked like with this new revolution of streaming that had hit us. Mm-hmm. And now the price of money is expensive, and people are kind of looking into Canada and Europe as a cheaper model, and we're really trying to work on figuring out how to bring it all back right now.
So it's not about credits or about the state as much as it is about national?
Oh, absolutely. It's an international issue. I mean, year over year, you were seeing 25, 30, 40. Now I think we're up to 50 and 60% down in the amount of production in the United States at the moment. So, yeah, it's a overall money issue. It's not a state or a credit issue at all.
And the reason for that is currency rates or labor cost or what?
Currency, all of those. Currency rates, labor costs, those are the two biggest ones. And then obviously all of your other countries have their own tax credit system. And so you may have seen in the news recently you know, President Trump in January came out and said he wanted to try to, you know, find a way to keep film in the United States, and he put an advisory council together, and they actually just had an article came out yesterday that John Voight, one of the people on that council, is going to come up with an opportunity to have a discussion around a federal film incentive, which would be interesting. But what's really interesting is that here in the state of Louisiana, you have one of the powerhouse film commissioners right out of Baton Rouge by the name of Katie Pryor, who had actually 4 years ago put together an association called Film USA to try to create a federal film office to have a conversation around how we keep production in the United States. And she's doing really well federally to begin to set that up right now.
So traditionally, it seems as though we've been competing with other states. So if there's a federal office, what does that do with the interstate competition, I guess?
Well, first you have to obviously take care of the overarching problem of keeping it here, right? And if we have somebody in power, just like you do right now with a lot of people in the federal government from Louisiana, if you have somebody in that position from Louisiana, they obviously recognize that Louisiana is one of the first places, if not the first place in the United States, that created a federal, a state tax incentive. And so we are the topic of conversation, hopefully, and you create an awareness around the state that has really started to enhance something in the U.S. And therefore, you hope you can capsulate on that, and people want to continue coming back as they have for over 25 years to take advantage of the opportunities we have here with great crews, great locations, and great people and culture that really brings them back over and over again.
So what about, like, numbers of people that are working now as opposed to used to be working, or productions in process, et cetera?
Well, it's pretty low. I mean, right now, I think we have two very small films on the ground, below $5 million. Normally, we would have anywhere between 8 and 12 films, you know, at our peak at one time, sometimes in the realm of 15, depending on how the size of them. So, in Louisiana as well as across the South, is looking at a very low number of people working at the moment, and it's very unfortunate, and we're really looking forward to picking that back up again.
So how quickly can something like this turn around?
Well, I mean, just look at, you know, the winds of change in the political and in the financial realm. They can change rather quickly. It really just kind of depends on what's happening in the global environment of, again, finance and labor. And so what does that dollar look like? That can make it change rather quickly. Or you can do what our organization with Film Louisiana is doing, is work with your leaders in government, which we're doing right now in this fiscal session, to really make a very strong case to make our program, you know, much more competitive, if not the most competitive in the U.S., and have conversations around what does it look like to begin to garner that business back up again. And that's what we're doing right now in both the House and the Senate, is we're having really great positive conversations. We're also having them with, obviously, the Secretary of LED on how we can enhance that here in the state of Louisiana.
So does that mean people leave the state? Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, because I'd like to know, first of all, you know, we always talk about the ancillary effects in businesses that are aided by Hollywood South. What's happened to them? I know there's been a lot of capital investment off of Market Street with studios. What happens to that? And what about the people that work in the film industry? What happens to them now with that? Give me the percentage of it that's moved out of the United States.
I think it's upwards in 50 to 60% that has moved out of the U.S. currently.
So
big number.
And shows that were produced here, they just change a set. They just do whatever they have to do to make it look like somewhere else and shoot it in a different country.
Or they rewrite it for a specific setting or location that they can find in that other country where it can become less expensive.
All right, let me hear from you on the Okunard Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Text, data, message rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Have you been affected by the slowdown in the Hollywood South film industry? And if so, how did it affect you, and where did you go? What did you do? What are you doing now instead of working in that? 820 Traffic Now, WWL. 824 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jason Wagenspack, president of Film Louisiana, about 60%, he says, of domestic film and TV production, correct me if I'm wrong, Jason, has gone overseas. Is that accurate? foreign countries?
That's accurate. That's correct.
And that's 60% of production in Louisiana or in a country, and has Louisiana been disproportionately affected?
That's across the country. Louisiana, you know, in the South, actually, in general, is probably a little bit lower. You still have, you know, something a little bit higher than 50% in Los Angeles and New York, mostly because they're media capitals. But all of your other tax credit states are seeing a significant reduction in and around 50, if not below 50%.
So somebody texted in, they're trying to get a handle on this, as am I. The main reason for this would be what?
It's the exchange rate. So the cost of money going across the border to Canada or to Europe. It is the cost of labor from the U.S., as well as the difference between it in Canada and in Europe. And then it's also the additional tax credits on top of both of those things that I just mentioned in each of those respective countries that they offer. So they're getting a lot more money to go a lot farther for each of their major productions outside the U.S.
So one would, it would just, boy, I guess they do it with local crews. I'm just wondering how you can, is it analogous to manufacturing or not?
They do it with local crews, or they will take our U.S. crews and ship them over there because it's still cheaper to ship them and take the credit and get the exchange on the amount that they're paying them over there than it would be to film in the United States right now.
So when did this begin, this trend, if you will, or that...
It slowly began, I would say, 12 to 18 months ago, mm-hmm. and then it really ramped up in last fall. So I would say, you know, October, November, it really kind of ramped up where they were noticing a lot more projects heading out of the country.
So I talked about capital investment with studios off of Market Street and so forth that I've seen firsthand. Are those facilities idle now? And what does that mean as far as future capital investment?
Yeah, a lot of us are idle. We're on hold. We're obviously waiting to figure out what the summer's going to look like. We're having conversations with all the studios. The studios are still looking at us. We're still one of the top four in the country. We still have, you know, one of the best, if not the best, incentive that we feel in the country by allowing for an additional percentage for local labor to be hired. And we have the strongest and best crews in the U.S. We hear that over and over and over again. And so we're really having great conversations. It's just... It is all about what is happening within the realm of the dollar. And so, you know, there is an interesting equation that came out recently that stated, you know, when the dollar hits between 26 and 27 cents in Canada, that 27 cents, that one penny, the majority of the U.S. production is heading over to Canada. Well, it's 29 cents right now that you save when you hop the border. So until we start to see some of that come down, or until we start to have an understanding of what federally we can do to incentivize more production to stay here, then we're going to start seeing some significant changes in the U.S.
I asked for texts, and somebody did text in a question. I don't know if it's cause and effect or just their perception, but they said, I've worked in the film industry for 18 years locally, ever since a strike in 2022, 2023. The amount of films have dwindled to peanuts. I've been forced to try and find another way of living in these hard times. Did the strike have anything to do with any of this?
Yes, of course. You know, obviously the strike it lifted up labor. It lifted up the cost of how much it would take for you to pay to have that labor on your production. So, you know, we obviously are in favor of people getting a fair wage. But unfortunately, just the way the entire shape and landscape of the world and how labor is construed in other places was looked at differently by the studios and said, well, we're going to go where it's cheaper because, one, we're losing money in the streaming market. We're losing money at the theaters, and we need to find a way to save money. And so there's this interesting dynamic happening right now of the industry trying to figure out how to build revenue and then obviously how to save money at the same time. You either cut productions or you cut costs on productions. And right now they're doing a bit of both. Even though we see an uptick of the amount of productions that are kind of going on this year, they're still looking, obviously, overseas and in Canada, as I mentioned, to save on those dollars to help generate a savings to subsidize for the revenues that they're losing at the box office and the streaming.
So was the strike the catalyst that really started all of this?
I think the catalyst that started all this was the inception of us having to be forced into watching streaming content during COVID, because you had started to see and move in the direction of wanting to move into streaming content with all the studios, but they were forced to do that during COVID because you couldn't go to theaters. And so they couldn't quite understand the dynamic of how to make a dollar off of streaming right off the bat. And then they noticed 2 years down the line, because in 2021, 2022, you had an influx. You had a massive bubble of production that started to explode. We had productions everywhere. We could not fill enough spaces. And so what they ended, they couldn't find enough spaces to fill all the projects that were coming in. And so what you started to recognize was this bubble burst because of the amount of money that wasn't being generated streaming, and they were trying to figure out the dynamic of how to actually make a dollar in the theater, and that started to crumble. And so that is where we're sitting right now. We're sitting in this lull of how do studios make money again so that they can obviously understand how the market is going to be affected.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. It ain't nothing simple, man. Everything's complicated. Jason Wagensmack, president of Film Louisiana. We'll take a break, come back, talk to J.P. Morrell about trash in the French Quarter right now. Time for WWL First News. All right, there we go. Desire for Politics, J.P. Morrell. You want to take us back to how this whole thing got started?
Well, really, I want to start by kind of agreeing with him. I think the problem is, and the media kind of gave him this gift. The issue we had with the contract was not just Richard's disposal. That's just what the media chose to report on.
Okay.
The issues we had were Richard's disposal. It was the fact that the contract value was raised after the bid was closed and that he was replacing Richard's with a sub that had a sub, as you recall from Monroe. So I think this narrative that y'all kind of let him hang on with this whole idea that Richard's was the only issue, it wasn't the only issue, and we challenged them on a couple of issues. Now, what's happened since then is that as time has gone on and as we've had more opportunities to dig into this contract, and I want to applaud Newell Norman for really highlighting this, there have been some other significant developments in how illegal this contract is. The biggest issue being, and we're going to talk about it with Newell later today, is that the city, in a move that really was breathtaking, not only allowed this person to operate with half a bond, an operational bond, which is required in the RFP and required in the other four of five trash contracts, but they also allow him to be prepaid each month. So, for example, if he's picking up trash in September, he can bill on September 1st, and we are required pursuant to Net 30 to pay him before the end of the month. Mm-hmm. No contractor in the city that we can find has ever been prepaid before. The other four trash contracts follow the typical method that most businesses operate under, which is once services are rendered, the day at the close of the month where the services were provided, we have 30 days to pay you. So every time we kind of peel a layer back from this contract, there's different increasing layers of legality. Now, I want to highlight with the insurance bond, in order to have that bond cut in half, the charter specifically states the director of finance has to not only authorize, but provide an explanation as to why it's necessary. In the meeting yesterday, the attorney, the poor overworked attorney who did this contract, admitted, as well as everyone else at the table, that the director of finance, Rami Samuel, was never consulted. So the reduction in the bond to half price was illegal on its face, and that is another issue that invalidates this whole rushed contract that is not in the interest of the city, of ratepayers, citizens, or visitors, but it's purely for Mr. Henry's benefit. And my job as a council member is to make sure money's being spent properly, not to make sure that Mr. Henry can get rich quick.
All right, let me say a couple of things there. First of all, you and Newell are attorneys. I am not, and I guarantee you there are people listening right now saying, oh, that's interesting. What's a bond that was cut in half? So explain that, if you will, JP, please.
So basically, when you enter a contract to provide a service, especially a service of this magnitude, a professional service contract, you have to get insurance to say that, hey, if for some reason I go bankrupt or can't do the job, I get a bond with an insurance company so that you can hire someone to do the job. So let's say we hire Troy Henry, his company goes belly up. The city would be on the hook without a bond to scramble to pay someone else to come in, potentially because Mr. Henry's already paid to do the work. So bonds are pretty frequently required, and in particular with all of our other four sanitation contracts, it is required, and it was spelled out in the RFP he responded to, that the city required 100% bonds. The problem you have with a half a bond, Scoot, is that
Tommy,
I'll give you an example of September again. Sorry, Tommy, you're going to kill me for that.
That's right, Joe, don't worry about it.
So if, let's say, in September, we pay him at the beginning of the month, he says, I pay him for September on the 1st, we pay him on the 5th, and then for some reason he can't perform, with a full bond, his insurance company would replace that position and have someone perform. In that same example, if he had half a bond and couldn't perform in September, but we'd already paid him, his insurance would provide half the money for that month, and the city would have to come out of pocket for the other half of the money to get someone to step into his shoes.
Would the bond be a consideration if he would not be prepaid?
Not really, because the reality is in the charter it says the only reason you can do a bond reduction under the charter as the director of finance is to make it commensurate with similar contracts in the same annual period. So if we had four other sanitation contracts and one other contract had half a bond, there might have been some discretion for the director of finance to say, well, we've already established that a half a bond's okay. Mm-hmm. Sure, he could have a half a bond too. Nobody else had a half a bond. And remember, Tommy, there were four other responsive bidders who respond to the RFP paying for a full bond. There's no reason why the city shouldn't have said, you're no longer responsive. If you can't get a full bond, there are four other groups out there that can. We should not be putting the city at risk to accommodate Mr. Henry. I know that he believes that he provides a stellar, awesome service that is like special, extra special, snowflake, whatever, but there are other people that do trash. City Torres does trash. Romelli does trash. Waste Pro does trash. Clean Force, one of the subcontractors under him, was also a competitor. There are plenty of groups that were lining up to do the same contract at a full bond, not getting prepaid.
So when you say
the only person this...
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we get back. When you say the contract value was raised, you mean as soon as he was awarded, and you can answer when we come back, as soon as he was awarded the contract, he came back with a change order almost, and was that related to a problem with a subcontractor or a subcontractor of a subcontractor? We'll pick it up when we come back. 852 Traffic Now, WWL. 857, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with J.P. Morrell talking about trash and French Quarter and Henry Consulting, and Newell's going to spend a lot of time with JP later on about this. We're just kind of trying to give you a little tease of it. So you started, JP, by saying that the problem was not with A, but with the fact that the contract value was raised. You're saying it was raised immediately after the RFP was awarded, and then he issued a change order or something, or what? Or asked for?
Basically, after the contract was awarded, the value was about $7 million. He renegotiated because he misunderstood the special event requirements and added an additional $500,000 onto it. But I want to add one quick thing. Yesterday, what was uncovered, going back to the bond, when he was awarded that $7 million as the initial bid, that was contemplating him purchasing a full bond. The premium on the bond is actually absorbed by the contract itself. The contractor just required to get authority to have a bond of that magnitude. Now, here's the interesting thing. For a $7 to $8 million bond, it's about $300,000 a year as the premium the city would pay. When the final contract was brought before the council, he had already gotten authority to cut his bond in half. Now, Tommy, when your bond is half, your premium is half. Mm-hmm. One thing that was brought up yesterday that Matt Torrey confirmed is that when he cut his bond in half and his premium got cut in half, he did not reduce the cost of said bond to the city. So the city, in his contract, was paying for an $8 million bond when, in fact, he had gotten authority to get a half a bond, which meant his lack of a larger bond led to a net profit within the contract.
Now, let me get to this real quick. Real quick, 90 seconds left. Troy Henry told me that there was no emergency that required an emergency contract with Sidney Torres. You would say what to that?
He did not have a contract because the council did not approve it. Since he did not have a contract, Tommy, there was no one to pick up trash in the French Quarter. It was absolutely an emergency. And I would add, Mr. Henry still doesn't have a contract, which is why Mr. Torres should continue picking up trash until the courts weigh in.
Did he not have a contract because the council didn't approve it and that created the emergency? I'm just trying to understand this.
The contract that the city signs requires three signatures: the mayor's, the council's, and his own. The council never passed a motion to sign the contract. Tommy, if your contract's unsigned, you don't have a contract.
Did that create the emergency? You didn't have a contract because the council didn't sign it, I guess is what I'm asking.
Correct. There were irregularities in this contract, so the council didn't sign it. So therefore, there was no contract for the French Quarter, which required the administration to do an emergency contract to make sure trash got picked up.
When are you going to be on with Newell?
I believe at 12:10.
All right, so tune in more with Newell Norman at 12:10. J.P. Morrell will continue the saga of the garbage pickup. In the French Quarter, we'll come back, talk about the Saints draft, and we'll also talk about mental health. Lord knows we all need that. Back in a flash. 9:20 again. You can hear more of J.P. Morrell talking about the trash contract with Newell Norman, both of them lawyers, and you can get down to it, pardon the pun, the heart of the matter at 12:10. That's one of my favorite songs. The more I know, the less I understand all the things I thought I knew. I'm learning it again. Those are Don Henley's lyrics. And if I'd have told you 2 weeks ago, look, we're going to find out about Derek Carr's shoulder injury from Derek, but it'll be while he's preaching a sermon at church, you would have said, Tucker, enough drinking. It's time to dry out. But that's pretty much what happened. With that, we welcome in Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey, Tommy. How you doing?
I'm all right. I guess we did find out from Derek Carr about his shoulder injury at church in Las Vegas.
Yeah, sorry, you're cutting out a little bit. Can you repeat that question?
I say, so we found out about Derek Carr's shoulder injury in Las Vegas when he was preaching at church.
Well, you know, we knew about it, right? So it's more so that he's confirming that it exists, which, you know, I don't think he felt like he should have to do. But, yeah, it was weird because, you know, you watch him talk in that setting, and he's talking to the people standing in front of him, mm-hmm. or sitting in front of him, rather. But it's very much something directed at, you know, a much larger audience, because he's smart enough to know that that's mm-hmm. going to be seen and shared. And, you know, he talked about some lady on a podcast, which, you know, Diana Rossini is who he's referring to. She hosts a podcast called Scoop City with Chase Daniel. And, you know, I wouldn't say that she kind of came out and said that she didn't believe the injury was real, but she heavily implied that there was more to it than was being shared. I think it would be hilarious if she changed her Twitter bio to some lady on a podcast, personally. I mm-hmm. think she would win the internet for the day if she did that. But, no, and so, you know, he talked about a lot. You know, he said that, you know, he's had a very tumultuous off season. You know, he shared some intimate details of a trip they took where they all got sick, and, you know, his wife, they had to rush her to the burn unit because of a weird explosion at home. And mm-hmm. then, you know, they found out later that she had a miscarriage. They didn't know she was pregnant. And that was around the time that he was supposed to come to New Orleans. That's the details he shared. So obviously you feel for the family. It's a tragic situation, traumatic situation, anytime something like that happens. So, you know, your thoughts and prayers are with them. But, you know, it's just another kind of episode of the off-season soap opera that is Derek Carr and the Saints, because it's anything but normal. It is a complicated, complex situation seemingly at all times. There are a few answers. The Saints haven't really come out and said anything. I think they're hoping to get more information so that when they talk about the situation at length, they are able to do so from a place of, hey, we have answers for you. We're not presenting more and more questions. And especially in the build-up to the draft, they didn't want that to be the case. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I still think surgery is probably the most likely outcome when you're talking about a 34-year-old quarterback. I think the question is going to end up being, hey, do you want to have surgery and fix this issue? Do you want to try to play through it? We don't know what that's going to look like. Do we want to rehab it without surgery? So, you know, I think this is all going to kind of come to a head in the next few weeks or so. The Saints are going to be on the field for their rookie mini camp in mid-May. They have OTAs starting, you know, a few weeks after mm-hmm. that. So the first time Derek has to be here in terms of it's mandatory is the veteran mini camp in June. So I think by that point, by, you know, June 20th or whatever, I don't have the exact date in front of me. I have a feeling we'll have an idea one way or the other of where exactly he stands.
And my thoughts are, I feel for him and his family, but looking at moving forward, you got to play with who you have, not who you don't have. And right. Along those lines, let's go through the Saints draft, if we will. You can talk about Kevin Banks, and we'll get to Tyler Shuck.
Well, which one do you want to talk about? You want to talk about both?
Start with Kevin Banks. Just real quick, a recap, and then we'll get to Tyler Shuck.
Well, first, Kelvin. He'll get mad if you call him Kevin. We learned that with Kelvin Sampson, the coach for Houston.
I'm just reading what they gave me here. Is his name Kevin or Kelvin?
Kelvin, like the temperature.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, we had Archie Manning on yesterday, and he has some insight into Kelvin because Kelvin was the left tackle at Texas. And, you know, Arch Manning didn't play a ton last year, but when he did, he spoke very, very highly of Kelvin, said when he was the best person in that locker room, independent of football, just from a character perspective. And, you know, that's what we heard a lot of from people who know him, from the coaching staff that, you know, scouted him, is, you know, you're adding a very, very high character, high quality person. And, you know, I get it. Every time you go into the draft, there's so many exciting names, especially when you're drafting in the top 10, you kind of have all these visions of, wow, what if we added this stud wide receiver, this stud running back, or, you know, the super exciting tight end. And then you end up with an offensive lineman. And it's like, there's no highlight reels of offensive linemen I can go gush over and get excited about. But then you kind of take a step back and you say, how do you win at the NFL?
Yeah,
level?
When it's game, I was going to say, when it's game day and you need to run the ball for 5 minutes, forget the highlights. Yeah. That's what I want to see.
Right. Right, and like, it's easy to forget. This time last year, we were all panicking about, can Trevor Penning play right tackle or left tackle? Do you have to have a tackle? And now, instead of that question, you have a guy you drafted last year and feel great about in Taliese Fuaga, who you could play, either keep him at the left side or move him back to his natural position of right tackle. And then you have this stud tackle who you probably want to play at left tackle in Kelvin Banks, and your only real question is, do we move Trevor Penning into guard? Do you use Dylan Raidens? There's so many options that you have now that, like, I think the team is thrilled to be able to get a guy they were really high on and just solidify that left tackle, especially now knowing that they wanted to go with Tyler Shuck in the second round, a guy I've been high on throughout the process. And, you know, one of the interesting things is, so, okay, you move Trevor Penning into guard. One of the issues with a guy like Trevor Penning playing guard is he's like 6'8". You got to see over that guy. You know, the Saints have spent two decades basically, you know, throwing guys out there. You have to stand on their tippy toes to see over the offensive line. You had Tyler Shuck. He's 6'5". He's more of your traditional, prototypical quarterback build. He could see over that guy. It's not going to be an issue for him. So I do think that's interesting. And just kind of rolling into the Tyler Shuck conversation, I'm a big fan of Tyler Shuck. He was my mock draft pick when I put it out on Monday. I actually had the Saints trading up to go get him. I thought they were going to feel a little pressure. The way the quarterback class kind of unfolded, I think they felt a little more comfortable sitting there at 40. But they were very high on this guy. They did not feel like it was a reach. Yes, maybe he could have been available a few picks later, but you were not. If you wanted him, you were not going to say, we'll just kind of hold our water until 71, wait 31 picks and hope no one agrees with us that this guy is a very good quarterback. So I think they're very happy with their first two picks.
Tell me what kind of quarterback he is. What's he remind you of for people that didn't see a lot of the highlights, don't know a lot about him from Louisville, Tyler Shuck, other than his name is going to be ridiculously hard to pronounce.
Yeah, so his name is spelled differently than it sounds. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing people have to kind of figure out.
It's 9:30, and we're back with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter, talking about Tyler Shuck. For people that aren't familiar with him, Jeff, you're getting ready to tell us. Susie, remind you of, give me some quarterback comparisons, and is he likely to play this year?
Yeah, I'm missing a lot. We're kind of cutting in and out. I don't know what the deal is. But, like you mentioned, you know, he's 6'5". You know, a lot of the criticism you'll hear is he's 25 years old. He'll be 26. In his rookie season, I get it. But I don't think the Saints view that as an issue. I think they view that as a positive. He's going to show up and be a little more pro-ready. You know, he's also has an injury history. His three seasons at Texas Tech, he broke his collarbone twice. He broke his fibula once. These are kind of freak injuries. They're not orthopedic injuries. They're kind of, okay, contact injuries. Texas Tech, he was asked to run a lot. He went to Louisville in a more pro-style offense. He wasn't asked to run as much. He didn't get hurt. So I don't think they're super concerned about that either. And the question to me becomes, okay, who is he as a quarterback? You know, he's a very mature quarterback. He understands, hey, I would rather throw the ball away than take a sack. That's something that, you know, has been criticized in college. But at the end of the day, that's a pro trait. Professional quarterbacks, guys who last in the NFL, understand that I am much better off cutting my losses, understanding when a play is dead, and dirting a ball than taking 5, 6, 8, 9 sacks a game. Like, you watch how Spencer Rattler played last year.
I throw an interception.
Versus how Derek Carr played last year.
Turning it over.
Yeah, and so, right. And so, like, I think that's something that they view as a positive trait. I kind of look at Jared Goff as kind of the top-end comparison, and I know some people are like, oh, Jared Goff. I mean, if you watch Jared Goff, like, that's a good comparison, right? This is a guy who threw for 4,700 yards last year. He's a four-time Pro Bowler. He's been to a Super Bowl, and we don't need to bring up how he got there. But, you know, he was fifth in the MVP voting last year. And what Jared Goff does and what his superpower is he gets the ball out. He understands how to play from within the pocket. He can extend, but when he extends to throw. He can take off. I would say Tyler's a little more athletic than Jared. If you go back and watch his tape at Oregon, where he started, he backed up Justin Herbert for 2 years and then played during the COVID year. So it was only seven games in 2021, I guess. But, you know, what he's able to do is when he gets out in a straight line, you know, he can go. Now, he's not trying to juke people, make people miss downfield. He's going to get down rather than take a hit. But, you know, he's a guy that can get out of the pocket and move. So, no, I mean, I think when people see him out there, they're gonna kind of get the picture of like, okay, I get it. You know, you're talking about 6'5", strong arm. You know, he's able to roll out of the pocket and make really good throws downfield. He's got a good ability to kind of throw from multiple arm slots. So you'll see him when needed to kind of drop down and kind of like a Matt Stafford-esque kind of like sidearm throw. He said Matt Stafford was a guy he came up watching a lot of. So you can see a little bit of that in his game. But no, I mean, it's the number 40 pick in the draft. You're not taking a guy at number 3 and saying, well, this guy has to be a superstar. It was a terrible pick. You know, you're taking a guy at number 40 and saying, we feel good about it, and we'll see. I think he could very well be your week one starter, just like Bo Nix was the week one starter for Denver last year. It'll depend on whether Derek Carr is healthy and whether, you know, and you go through camp and you say, who's the better quarterback? Is it Spencer Rattler? Is it Tyler Shuck? But I think Tyler's going to have a really, really – unless they're trying to protect him because they don't think he's ready, they don't think the team is ready around him, if he shows up and looks better than Spencer Rattler, there's no question you would throw him in there.
Let's talk about the rest of the Saints draft choices. Vernon Broughton?
Yep.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, so Vernon's an interesting one. I would say when you talk about reaches of the draft, he might be the best answer in terms of the read on him at 71 was he probably would have been there at 93. The Saints really liked him. Defensive tackles are, you know, not easy to find in the mid rounds. If you feel like you have a guy that is a plug and play defensive tackle, you go get him. The Saints had really, really good intel on him. Bo Davis, who's the Saints defensive line coach now, obviously after a year at LSU, was the Texas defensive line coach for 3 seasons prior to that. So he coached Vernon. We asked Vernon about it. He loves Bo Davis. He said they're like family. If you go and you look at so the Saints post the draft calls when they call the guy and tell him he got picked, they actually had Bo make that call to tell Vernon he was coming to the Saints. He called him chicken legs, which I think is funny because when you see the guy, he's this massive human being. And he also said, he's like, you're my Easter basket. It's kind of like a joke, but it was, you know, I'm sure that one of the reasons Vernon is here is because Bo Davis gave him a very, very strong stamp of approval. So, you know, it's a position of need and I like it.
Jonas Sanker, safety.
Jonas. It's actually Jonas like Valanciunas. Yes.
Okay.
You know, he's an interesting guy, too. You know, both him and Danny Stutzman, who was the next pick out of Oklahoma, Jonas was the final day 2 pick. Danny was the first day 3 pick. And what they have in common is both guys are elite tacklers. They are highly productive players. If you combine their stats over the last 2 seasons between Oklahoma and Virginia, they've combined for more than 400 tackles. Like, these are guys who you can plug in as core special teamers from day one and feel like we can develop these guys. Jonas in particular is kind of fascinating because he actually came up playing 8-man football, which, you know, is really kind of a unique thing. Scott Shanley, former Saints linebacker, also came up playing 8-man football. We had him on WWL radio yesterday. He describes it as arena football without the arena. It's really high paced, but you still got to go out there and make tackles. He played quarterback and safety in that situation, and he made some big hits that kind of got him on the scouts' radar, and then so he ends up at Virginia and is highly productive. So I think he's going to be a really intriguing guy. You know, I mean, C.J. Gardner-Johnson would be a good comparison in that same range in terms of the third, fourth round. But yeah, I like both those two guys as core special teamers right away, who can potentially, you know, DeMario Davis, as much as it seems like he's going to play forever, eventually he's going to have to call it a career. So you are still looking for inside linebackers, guys who can fill in. And so Danny, I think, is a really good candidate for that.
And I know you like the tight end from UCLA. I'm not going to even pretend to know how to pronounce his name. Say it.
Maliki Matavau. One more thing on Danny, which is interesting. Yeah. So Danny Stutson's father, Steve, was actually a teammate of Jeff Ireland at Baylor. Okay. Jeff Ireland, the Saints assistant GM, was a kicker at Baylor. Steve was a tight end, which kind of leads, okay, so the tight end out of UCLA, Maliki Matavau. I actually talked to him at the Senior Bowl, and one of the things that stuck with me, and he was a mock draft pick of mine, so that's a, you know, mark it off. Anytime I can get a seventh-round pick right, I feel pretty good about my mock draft. But, yeah, one of the reasons I was really high on him is because when I talked to him at the Senior Bowl, I asked him, hey, what do you want to work on this week? What is the most important thing for you to come out here and do? And he said, I want to work on run blocking. I want to come out here and put my hand in the dirt and beat up some edge rushers. And, you know, that's to me what the Saints needed to add, was not only a guy who can physically block, be that blocking tight end option, a guy who wants to do it, a guy who embraces it as his role. Because to me, you know, so much, yes, you want to have a guy with the physical traits to be an elite run blocker. But so much of that equation is wanting to go out there and do it, wanting to get isolated with a defensive end who's probably going to make you look bad, but surviving and putting in the work to make it happen. And so if you can get a guy with the traits, he's 6'6", 250, pretty athletic, a little stiff in his hips, kind of stiff getting downfield, but that's not really what I'm going to be asking him to do. When I can get a guy with the traits I need in the seventh round, 248 overall, I feel good about it. So I think it was a solid kind of late-round value pick for him.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it, as always. And Stutzman, I'm surprised, didn't go higher. You?
Stutzman?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy because he didn't get a lot of interest. The Saints were the only team that worked him out.
I just remember watching him play, and I thought he'd go up there. We'll see. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Dr. Judy Ho about handling stress and finding the sweet part of life, even though sometimes it can be sour right now. Traffic, WWL. Hi, 944, 16 till 10. We're very concerned about mental health here, and every other Tuesday we talk to our friend Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast and several books. How are you, Dr. Judy?
Doing great. How are you, Tommy?
I'm well, thank you. I know a lot of stuff is going on in the world, and a lot of people are having a hard time finding joy, or they're worried about this or worried about that. So we thought we'd talk about, and I'm looking at an article of Psychology Today, how to feel more joy even when the world feels heavy. And for a lot of people, the world does feel heavy, whether it's from a macro or a micro standpoint.
Yeah, you know, such a relevant topic. And I would say that it really has to do a lot with your mindset and also what you choose to consume. I definitely notice a difference. If I consume a bit too much negative news, it really does color my mood the rest of my day, and even sometimes have nightmares related to, in theme, some of what I just consumed or read. And so, of course, you want to stay informed. You want to make sure that you are being practical and that you're being grounded and you're staying in touch with things. But at the same time, so much of our thoughts are colored by what we're exposed to. And if to the point that you have any choice over the matter, you need to have more balanced consumption of information. And that means also spending time consuming positive and helpful information that makes you feel good.
You know, Dr. Judy, I totally agree with you. And sometimes, you know, you can find yourself, I don't know if you want to call it doom scrolling or whatever, but you see, you know, stuff is going on that you don't necessarily agree with. You see one thing, you see another, and then before you know it, you find yourself spiraling. And it's like, wait, how did I get here? And again, if I had never seen any of that, I would never know about any of it, right?
Exactly. And yeah, that's right. I was thinking about the term doom scrolling as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that most of the times what you want to do is, you know, you of course want to stay in touch, but it's really just about setting a little time limit for yourself, right? 10 minutes. Or if you know that you already struggle with sleep, don't be reading those things in bed on your phone right before you go to bed. You know, you might want to read them in the middle of the day or something, and then buffer that with an activity you're going to do to get yourself off reading those articles. So maybe 10 minutes before you're supposed to have a meeting or have a lunch. You to spend 10 minutes getting up to date and informed, and then, you know, you have something that's already buffered on the back end where you have to get to, and then that's your natural stop, right? But I think the hardest thing is when people read really negative information right before they go to bed or right when they wake up, because your first moments when you wake up are so important for setting the tone of the day. That's the time when you should be doing a quick gratitude exercise or reading an inspirational quote. You don't want to start your morning consuming negative information and feeding negative energy.
I got a couple of texts coming in here. I'm going to combine them. One of them says, I tried to live in the moment, but what do you do when the moment sucks? And somebody else says, my significant other tells me happiness is a choice, but I don't think it is. Thoughts on all of that, Dr. Judy?
Yeah, you know, I really think that it is really hard sometimes when you're struggling with something and you're trying to find the positive. And I think to that point, it's not so much about finding joy in that particular struggle, but even just doing a quick gratitude exercise of, but what am I appreciated for? Even though this present moment sucks 98% of the time, is there something small that I can still say, I'm thankful for this? You know, that's one way. And then the other way is to struggle less with that particular reality. I think sometimes when we're in a negative moment, you're thinking about all the ways you wish it was different, but if you truly cannot change that moment because it's just a sucky moment and it is what is happening, it's really just about letting that go and saying, well, this is what's happening. The more you struggle with it, the more it's actually going to be painful and hurtful to you. So what can you do to have radical acceptance? And I know we have very little time, so we can't get into this concept, which I think is a life-changing concept if you can actually embrace it. But it's, look it up if you guys want to. Go Google radical acceptance. It's from dialectical behavior therapy. And it's really about, hey, you know you can't change it. The moment sucks. But it's almost basically saying, yet I still surrender and accept this reality, and I'm going to do the things that I can do to improve the moment or to improve my life, even if it can improve hugely upon this big thing that I'm upset about.
Is that the same as stoicism or not really?
No, stoicism, I think it can have, you know, obviously some benefits. Mm-hmm. If you do too much stoicism, you might be ignoring your problems. It's a little different. Radical acceptance is really just about embracing the fact that you can't change things. Really weird, right? It's very Buddhist in a way. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, well, like, you're going to just let your life be. And I think when you truly assess and you know you can't actually change what's happening, then that really causes you more peace. Because you know that it's not something that you could have done or should have done. But most of the time people struggle with that, right? Like, oh, what if I just made this other decision? Or what if I wasn't feeling this way or this wasn't happening to me? And that just creates more struggle with whatever it is that you're going on so that it actually makes the situation harder rather than either letting it be or hopefully making it slightly better.
What about happiness being a choice?
I do think that to some degree, happiness is a choice. There are some studies that show that happiness is part genetic, part personality-based, and part situational, right? So sometimes the situation is going to cause you to not feel super happy. However, if you have certain perspectives, outlooks, the way that your personality is formed, those are some things that can buffer it. And then the other part, which is about 40 to 50% of the components of happiness, is what you do and your outlook, right? So you have these little breakdowns where, okay, situationally, this is what's going on. Maybe there's some genetic pros and cons in terms of your general disposition, but about half of it is up to you. And I find that to be very encouraging. So even if somebody who has had clinical depression, where depression runs in their family, maybe their personality and outlook is just a bit more realistic, so they're not necessarily like a positive outlook person. But even for that individual, 50% of your happiness comes from what you choose to consume, the activities you do, how you choose to connect with people, and how you want to alter your thinking so that it's more balanced. All of those things can really help. And so I definitely think that it's important. It's a good lesson that there is so much that we can do to contribute to our own joy.
A text comes in. How important is it to have something to look forward to?
100% important. And that's why people say, you know, sometimes planning a vacation, planning a mental health break, it's almost as enjoyable, if not more enjoyable, than actually going on that vacation or finally taking that day off. And I really agree with that. So allow yourself to savor future experiences. Create things that you can look forward to. Do things that are meaningful to you. I like to create a joy list, and I have one of these, and I need to update it, actually. It's been a couple months, where essentially it's my top 10 to 20 items or things that, you know, they take varying amounts of time. Some are like just having a wonderful cup of coffee. That takes 5 minutes, and it's a source of joy for me. And then, of course, planning and going on a vacation, that's on the bigger end. But essentially, your joy list should be things that you find meaningful and that bring you happiness and that are essentially of different types of time commitments and resources. And just committing that you're going to look at this joy list every day and every couple of days try to do at least one thing. That goes a long way in cultivating your joy, and it does accumulate. So the more you have joyful moments, the happier overall you will become. It's kind of like dropping, you know, coins in the piggy bank. And so they all add up, and over time, you're going to really see the difference. But also in the moment, you're going to feel the difference.
And only a minute or two left, but something, if you can, Dr. Judy, about doing something for somebody else, because I know sometimes that's a good way to get out of your funk, by doing something for somebody else. You feel better about everything, and you don't necessarily dwell on yourself.
I think that is such a underestimated source of joy. I know that when I'm going through personal challenges, the best thing that I can do is connect with somebody else, help somebody else. Even when I go to work, if I have stuff going on, I'm worried about something, I go to work and immediately I'm immersed in trying to help somebody else. And it's amazing how mindful you can be when you're helping somebody else and how much that adds to even your own gratitude, because it really puts things in perspective and it brings joy to the other person. So you're passing that along and that makes you feel good and another person as well.
Thank you, Doc. Appreciate your time as always. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of Supercharged Life Podcast. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.